Welcome to MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. I'm Russ White. At 6 past the hour, following the latest news, all about Geography Awareness Week at MSU, a conversation with MSU College of Engineering Dean Leo Kempel, careers for women in the energy industry, and Dan and Jennifer Gilbert's gift to MSU.
It's an honor to be in a position to be able to contribute and help Michigan State University in any way we can. The truth of the matter is, you know, I'm very proud to have gone to Michigan State. Really am. I just feel like it's like there's just something about it. I can't even, there's really words don't describe it. It's like a can do, you just get it done.
MSU Today begins at 4:06. Tune to Greening of the Great Lakes inside MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Here's Kirk Heinze.
Well, an annual event on the MSU campus we always look forward to discussing is Geography Awareness Week, which kicks off next Sunday, November 13th. And as usual, the celebration features acclaimed special guests. This year, two highly talented filmmakers who have focused on the increasingly urgent issue of declining water supplies in Kansas. Back with us is Dr. Al Arbogast, professor and chairman of the MSU Department of Geography, Environment, and Spatial Science, which is hosting Geography Week. And Al himself is a Kansas native. Before we get into Geography Awareness Week, you've had some changes in the department. I just mentioned the new name. What are those changes?
Yeah, one thing, we are always kind of dealing with the challenge of how people perceive the discipline of geography. And so we've gone through a rebranding exercise and expanded our name to Geography, Environment, and Spatial Sciences to kind of let people know more up front that geographers work with aspects of the environment of all kinds and that we think about spatial relationships and how they interact with one another.
In addition to the name change, you've got a new major.
Yes, sir.
And a new concentration.
That's right. We have a new major in economic geography. People who work in that field are interested in things like location theory, which is why do you put a business or a shopping mall where you do? What are the different things that you think about? Traffic, site location, wetlands, those kinds of things. You know, it's a very important part of identifying where business is going to be. We're discussing the development of new concentration in atmospheric and climate sciences, which will look at, the way weather patterns and climate issues are affecting people.
Well, the economic geography is a great example of the human dimension of geography. And these speakers that are coming in for a Geography Awareness Week, I mean, one of them is a psychologist. They're going to be talking about human response to, in this particular case, climate change.
Yeah. And we've, during our Geography Week, as you know, we've brought in somebody who focuses on, like a presentation or a film that highlights how geography is relevant to human beings. Last year we had Roberta Bondar. You remember talking to her?
She was wonderful.
She was fantastic. Mm. And she was first Canadian astronaut, happened to be a woman, who gave a rousing presentation on viewing Earth from space and how geography was relevant to her. We had 700 people there for that event. This year, we're bringing in Steve Lerner and Ruben Aronson, who have created this film about how people are viewing the challenge of water scarcity in central Kansas, which is really interesting because as a native Kansan myself, I know that water is something that people think a lot about out there. Here in Michigan, been here 20 years now, It's not an issue that people think about much at all. You know, water's everywhere. And so we take it for granted here in Michigan, whereas folks out in my home state don't. And so with the Campus Water Initiative going on and challenges of water scarcity all around the globe, this will be a little bit of a window into that issue.
Now, this film, one of the films they're going to show is called When the Well Runs Dry. Has won multiple awards as in the documentary area. But both of these fellows that are coming in have a lot of film credits under their belt.
Yeah, they're very good. You know, Ruben has created films for NOVA, the National Geographic Society, and a whole host of other places. Steve has done similar work as well, and he's a composer. You know, he's interested in music. He emailed me yesterday about creating a collage of songs and tunes, such as Woody Guthrie's Dust Bowl Blues, that will be playing when people enter the theater on that night. So it's going to be a really good show.
Well, Steve also has a very strong psychology background and worked for the internationally known Menninger Clinic in Kansas. So the human, back to your point about the human dimensions of geography, I mean, if there's anyone putting a film together that could sort of underscore that, it would be a psychologist.
Yeah, right. And
from Kansas.
from Kansas, no less. We talked about that. And when I first reached out to Steve about working with us on this project, he was really enthusiastic about it. But he wanted to know how a psychologist would fit into a geography program. And I told him, I said, look, you know, one of the things that geographers do, it's a lot more than maps. One of the things that geographers do is they think about how humans are interacting with the environment and how they feel about places. And, some of that is just, amounts to digging ditches to get water from one place to another. But another thing is about your perception of where you live and the challenges that you face and how they differ from one place to another. Again, here in Michigan, we don't think about those issues from a psychological standpoint. Maybe if lake level goes down in Lake Michigan, 6 inches, people kind of freak out about that. But that's not the same thing as running out of water, which is some of the issues that they're dealing with in the plains in Kansas in particular. So when we talked about that, he realized that what he was doing was, in effect, good human geography. And so that's that kind of opened his eyes a little bit and is kind of a good example of what we're trying to do with our whole series.
Well, Al, in addition to some other things these guys are going to do, Ruben and Steve, Thursday, November 17th, they're going to do this montage of films and When the Well Runs Dry. That's at 7 p.m. at Wells Hall. Is that open to the public?
It is open to the public.
But better come early. I've been there before. It gets packed.
It does. It does. We're very happy about that. The events have been a rousing success for the 4 or 5 years that we've been doing them, 600 or 700 people each time.
Well, Geography Awareness Week coming up beginning next Sunday, November the 13th. I've been talking with Dr. Al Arbogast. He's professor and chairman in the MSU Department of Geography, Environment, and Spatial Science. Al, always a pleasure having you on the program.
Likewise, Kirk. Take care.
You're tuned to Greening of the Great Lakes inside MSU today on AM 870 WKAR. Here's more with Kirk Heinze.
Well, I've only seen the trailer for the multiple award-winning documentary When the Well Runs Dry, which chronicles the human and environmental impacts of accelerating water shortages in Kansas. And believe me, it was very moving and very powerful. I look forward to seeing the entire film on November 17th as part of Geography Awareness Week. And it is indeed a pleasure to welcome one of the documentary's co-creators, Steve Lerner, who, along with his partner, Ruben Aronson, will also make the journey to East Lansing. Steve, a pleasure to have you on the program.
Thank you, and it's going to be a lot of fun to come up there. Ruben and I are looking forward to it.
Steve, let's start with the conceptual genesis for When the Well Runs Dry.
Well, I had made another film about a small town in Kansas, Florence, Kansas, a couple of years earlier. A documentary about the town, its history, and the challenges a small rural town faces in Kansas. And I had heard a rumor during the making of that film that the town was worried about losing its water source. The town is famous for its very, very pure spring water. They won an award, I think, for the first or second best water quality in the state. And their water tower's on the National Historic Register. So when I heard that, it just sort of stayed in the back of my mind. And so I decided to investigate what that story was about. And we thought at first we'd make a very small film about one small water issue, what was going on in Florence, Kansas. But what I learned, and I'm not a water expert, I'm a psychologist and a filmmaker, what I learned as we investigated that water story is that when you look into one water issue, pretty soon you bump up against another, and then another, and then another, because there are so many issues pertaining to water, which is our most precious resource. And so the film started with that focus, but we ended up branching out across Kansas, everywhere from Florence all the way out to Sublette, Kansas, in the far southwest, where there mining the Ogallala Aquifer with estimates ranging from 30 to 50 years of water source availability. I mean, they're going to use up all that water.
How did you and Ruben, as you mentioned, both have extensive background in filmmaking, but you come from very different parts of the country. How did you hook up?
Well, actually, we grew up together on the same street in Chevy Chase, Maryland. And we've known each other pretty much all of our lives. And we had worked together on Ruben's very first film when he started his career, and I hadn't done anything in film, really. And we made a short film in about 1971 in Berkeley, California. And then for the last 10 years or so, I've been after Ruben. I said, we've got to make another film before we're too old to even think about it. And he said, sure, we could go to Peru, we could go to, you know, Brazil. Where would you like to go? And so I said to him, how about Florence? And he said, oh, I love Tuscany. And I said, no, Florence, Kansas. And there was a dead silence on the phone. And actually, though, Ruben had been out here prior working on a film on the Dust Bowl, where he interviewed a lot of Dust Bowl survivors here, and then they recreated some Dust Bowl scenes in New Mexico. And in fact, when we show When the Well Runs Dry, we're going to actually have a couple of clips prior to the film. The first one will be some excerpts from this Dust Bowl film he made called The Black Blizzard, which is quite dramatic. And then we're going to show a 90-second clip out of my film about Florence, Kansas, which documents the flood of 1951. So what we want to get across is that Kansas and many other areas have a very varying climate when it comes to water, a cycle of wet to dry to wet. But then when you factor in climate change, which our film addresses a bit, you start seeing that it's not just a natural cycle that we're dealing with now.
Steve, from the trailer, again, I mentioned a very compelling and moving trailer. You, as you mentioned, you bring psychology to your work as a filmmaker. You bring a music background. But it seems to me, and correct me if I'm wrong, but the real poignant part of this is really the human impact that this climate change and this environmental issue has.
Yes, you're exactly right. And in fact, we decided early on that we wanted to make a film with no professional narrator. We wanted to tell the entire story from the point of view of individual Kansans who are directly impacted by water issues. So we wanted to learn from them. It made it a very hard film to put together, because it's so easy to have a narrator saying, and now we'll move from topic A to topic B, and then give some, you know, explanation of it. But so we wove the film together just based on what people told us. So there was really no scripting in advance. It was totally created out of the video interviews we did. And we have a radio show there that we created. The radio moderator is actually an ex-rancher with a long background in water issues. So we never told anybody what to say. We just presented what somebody else said, and then they reacted to it. So it's a totally organic, from the ground up, sort of picture of water.
Steve, talking to Al Arbogast a little bit earlier about the human dimensions of this whole notion of place and the human dimensions of geography. I mean, he's very excited because he thinks that may be one of the take-home messages for the students and the faculty who actually come to the presentation.
No, I think that's right. And I happen to know that Al grew up not far from where I'm sitting right now. He grew up in Topeka, Kansas, where I lived for many years. And anybody who has a connection to Kansas is definitely going to resonate with this film. But I think, yeah, you get the sense of people, place, and water. And we also tried in the film, and this is really a strength Ruben brings. Ruben has such a well-developed aesthetic eye for how to create a shot and how to make a landscape really show its beauty. And we really tried to make the film beautiful, because in that way we were trying to show what it is these people love. I mean, they love where they live, whether there's water in abundance or not. And so it's people, place, and the resources and the climate.
One can't help but think about some of the broader implications associated with watching this film and the clips from your other films. I mean, do you have a sense of what kind of a longer-term impact your film might have with respect to the situation in Kansas?
Well, I don't know. I can say this. It's been amazing how much the film has been part of the discussion here. The film was funded by the Kansas Humanities Council, and they wanted to become part of the conversation about water in Kansas. And so the film showed at the governor's conference on water. It showed all across the state. I've been to, dozens of screenings. The first screening at a film festival was in the desert in Southern California, where the water issues are so profound because there is none. Because California, of course, has their share of severe water issues. So in terms of where the film goes, it's gone around the world. It just screened in Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia. I unfortunately couldn't make it to that one. But, I think it's an educational film in a way, and it may get distributed to universities. Our goal was just to make a film that would help prolong the discussion and help focus people's attention on it, and we wanted to tell a big story from local stories, if you see what I'm getting at, by touching on the major issues as they pertain to individuals on a farm, in a town, at a community reservoir. We wanted to try to bump up against the big issues, because I think when people watch real, authentic people talking about water and its impact on them, it's easy to leap to the larger issues in discussion. So we just hope it keeps going and keeps screening around the country and around the world.
Well, the film is When the Well Runs Dry. It will be aired on the Michigan State University campus during Geography Awareness Week, November 17th specifically at 7 p.m. at Wells Hall. I've been talking with Steve Lerner, who along with his partner Ruben Aronson created the film When the Well Runs Dry.
That was Dr. Kirk Heinze with a sustainability-focused Greening of the Great Lakes segment inside MSU Today here on AM 870 WKAR. To read Kirk's blog and hear more Greening of the Great Lakes content, visit mlive.com/environment.
This is MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR.
I'm Russ White for MSU Today. Here's Spartans Athletic Director Mark Hollis.
We're here today to celebrate. It's a celebration of two great Spartans who have committed themselves to changing the fortunes of this great city of Detroit and are now helping to transform Michigan State University. We're proud to announce today that Dan and Jennifer Gilbert, both graduates of Michigan State University, have made a $15 million gift to support the university. This generous gift will support the basketball programs as part of a new addition and renovation at the Breslin Center. It will also support two programs, the Detroit Scholars Program and the Resource Center for Persons with Disabilities, both of which provide critical support for students who have overcome unique challenges to get to college.
It's an honor to be in a position to be able to contribute and help Michigan State University in any way we can.
That's MSU alumnus Dan Gilbert.
The truth of the matter is, I'm very proud to have gone to Michigan State. Really, really am. I just feel like it's like there's just something about it. I can't even, there's really words don't describe it. It's like a can-do. You just get it done.
Tom Izzo says the gift means a lot to him.
It's not the building that you're going to help us build, but the people in it and what it stands for gives me a reason to gloat a little bit. I'm honored to go out recruiting, and you're in my recruiting speech, I want you to know, and as one of our greatest alums, and because you're an owner, that helps my recruiting. So
Izzo adds that the Gilberts' gift will help Spartans reach their dreams.
I've gotten a chance to live my dream, but I really haven't yet. And he makes me realize I haven't, because when you get done with one big dream, there should be another big, deep dream to try to accomplish. And that's what you've taught me. You have been a role model, as they said, for a lot of Spartans, but a lot of people. And I just want to thank both of you for helping another one of my dreams, you know, the future of Michigan State University, and then small part, Michigan State Athletics. But Michigan State University and what you're doing for it, what you're doing for people that aren't as privileged, aren't as lucky, but they too will get a chance to live their dreams. So my thing to you and Jennifer is thank you from the bottom of my heart for helping me live mine, helping me give a chance to other players to live theirs, but now you've expanded it to other students. And we are going to have, I think, the nicest facility in the country. And my job, make sure I put enough good players in there to help me and us now. Hell, maybe even you later. If I can find another LeBron, you know. So I'm going to try to do both. And thank you so very much for what you've done. I greatly, greatly appreciate it.
President Simon calls the Gilberts perfect examples of citizen scholars who embody the land-grant spirit.
When I think about what it means to be a land-grant scholar, a part of Michigan State in an old tradition, and what that really means and sets us apart, it's people who are extraordinarily talented in their own right. And they want to use that talent not just for themselves in terms of creating a building or a project, but how do you leverage that talent on behalf of others? Because it's leadership, investment of yourself, not just money, in order to transform for others, your community, and people you don't know. And in the gifts that we're announcing today, it does all of those kinds of things. It helps us to keep dreams bigger for folks who are part of our programs and activities, not just to make it, but to make their dreams bigger. And that's the lesson of a land-grant scholar, both Dan and Jennifer.
Mike Hudson leads MSU's Resource Center for Persons with Disabilities and appreciates what the Gilberts' gift will allow his team to do.
You know, disabilities should not, need not preclude the achievement of goals and dreams. Definitely, they're going to mandate some levels of creativity, a lot of commitment, and frankly, a repertoire of compensatory techniques. And the team at the Resource Center for Persons with Disabilities remains a leader, has engaged heavily in trying to let people see that brightest possibility that MSU means for so many people. Disabilities are not stopping people at Michigan State University.
Susie Merchant is MSU's women's basketball coach.
I say to my team and a lot of young people, you're not products of your environment. You're products of the people in your environment. And so when you step foot on Michigan State, there was many things there that probably changed you, and most of them were people. So I truly want to say thank you for what you've invested in Michigan State as a whole. And so to include Michigan State women's basketball in this vision, I just want to say thank you very much from the bottom of my heart.
I think it helps us in leaps and bounds, not just with the facility, but with the statement it says about a family that is giving back to a lot of different places here in Cleveland and Michigan State, and probably a lot more than I don't even know about. So that's what I'm so impressed with.
I'm Russ White for MSU Today.
This is MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Here's Russ White.
MSU's College of Engineering just announced a $5 million commitment for endowed scholarships from an anonymous donor.
He was a student from back in the, a few decades ago. And he came here from a farm. This was his chance to step up. Our college has always been a place of opportunity. He did very well.
That's the dean of Michigan State University's College of Engineering, Leo Kempel.
But as he got into the program, getting towards the end, he was running low on money, as many, many students experience. And so somebody stepped up with an endowed scholarship that time that allowed him to complete his degree. He went on to a very successful career and now wants to pay it forward by making it possible for many other students to get that same help that he got, of making sure that they have the financial wherewithal to complete the journey of becoming a Spartan engineer. So it's a tremendous gift. It's one that's going to impact students for generations to come. And in a very real sense for our college, it's transformational, because this one gift alone will make a substantial impact on the amount of scholarship dollars that we can give out to our students.
Another anonymous gift to MSU's College of Engineering will help our state's infrastructure resurgence.
Recently, we also had another anonymous gift, and you're going to get the idea that most engineers don't want the publicity, and that may be true, but we had another anonymous gift by a couple. Husband in the couple is a graduate from our college, spent a long time serving the people, and they accumulated enough wealth to make a very substantial gift of $2 million towards student support in bridges, infrastructure, the kind of things that make society go. And so, again, this is a gift that's going to keep on giving because it's an endowed gift, and it's going to make it possible for Michigan State to be an important part of the infrastructure resurgence in the great state of Michigan, not just in the near term, but for many, many generations to come. I can't think of a time that we're not going to need bridges and roads and all the other infrastructure that we use daily and don't think about, and unfortunately, as of late, have not been paying for.
Dean Kempel has welcomed Stanford scholar Christopher Contag to MSU
to lead two bold new initiatives in biomedical research. One of those is our newly formed biomedical engineering department. He'll be the founding chairperson of that. He's already going about the process of starting the hiring process for faculty to form that department, but also the Institute for Quantitative Health Science and Engineering, or as we like to call it, IQ. IQ is going to be a research institute that spans multiple colleges. This is a partnership between engineering, human medicine, and natural science. And so there will be faculty from all three of those colleges in the brand new bioengineering research facility, also the home of the Department of Biomedical Engineering, to work together. The idea is that when people from different backgrounds work together, we come up with solutions to today's problems that you couldn't find by staying within the silo of the traditional disciplines. So what IQ is going to allow is for engineers and biochemists and pathologists and et cetera to get together in ways that, quite frankly, wouldn't happen if the state and the Board of Trustees had not made the investment in the building and in the institute. And so at the same time he's standing up the department, Chris will be standing up this research institute. He's going to be a very, very busy man for the next few years. He brings world-class reputation in terms of his area of molecular imaging, really world-class, best there is. But in addition, he brings a high level of energy. And so I know that Chris is going to be able to not only transition research here, recruit people of the highest caliber to work here, but put together the connections that are going to make sure that when those people come, they do more than just the sum of the parts. This will be greater than the sum of the parts. There will be a synergy going on that makes IQ a signature activity on campus for healthcare-related research, not just for the next 5 years, but for the next 20, 25 years.
MSU has engineers researching connected and autonomous networked vehicles for active safety, or CANVAS.
Michigan has been the leading innovation site in transportation for well over a century. As transportation is evolving into mobility, the concept is it's not just transportation, it's bringing my life around with me and having all my ability to function as I would no matter where, in my car or in other vehicles on the road. You know, we really see the state of Michigan being the world leader in that. And so being Michigan State University, it's incumbent upon us to be part of that. And so we've stood up a program that we call CANVAS. And what CANVAS is it's a group of researchers from various areas coming together to work with not only the OEMs, but the Tier 1 and Tier 2 suppliers that really are part of the entire infrastructure of bringing vehicles forward. getting those people to work on technologies that make autonomy and mobility possible, such as sensors, right? Right now, the best sensor we have in a car are human eyes. The best computer we have in the car is the human brain. As we bring autonomy forward and causing this ability to have mobile solutions anywhere, anytime, we're going to have to improve the fidelity and the accuracy and the resiliency of sensors. So what better place than a research university like Michigan State University to do that work in partnership with our corporate friends? And so we've stood up Canvas to work on sensors. We stood up Canvas to work on the information fusion technologies. Some people call it big data. Information fusion is perhaps a little bit older term of how to take the inputs from these disparate sensors, both on the vehicle and from the infrastructure, in a way that reduces risk for the passengers and for the pedestrians and so forth around it. So we put a program together to explicitly go after aspects of the technology supporting mobility and supporting autonomy, where we believe that we really are world class.
MSU has long been recognized as a national leader in materials science and composites, as judged by the trust that the federal program IACME, the Institute for Advanced Composite Materials Innovation, has placed in MSU, says Dean Kempel.
So a very exciting project for us is one of the Manufacturing Innovation Institute stood up under the National Network of Manufacturing Innovation. This one's called IACME, the Institute for Advanced Composite Manufacturing Innovation. IACME is headquartered in Tennessee. We are the automotive partner here in Michigan. So the automotive hub of IACME is here in Michigan, led by Michigan State University. Our focus is on how can you make polymer composites high performance but low enough cost to where they impact the automotive industry? Here's a simple fact. The energy you use in a car, a big part of it is moving the mass of the car. Okay, if you can reduce the mass, you reduce the energy required. If you reduce the energy, you're burning less fossil fuels, you're putting less wear and tear on the vehicle itself. All things good by reducing mass. Yet it has to be safe. Nobody's going to want to buy a car where we're putting our children and our grandchildren at risk. And so we see advanced polymer composites as a key technology for mass reduction in vehicles, at the same time providing safety to the occupants. Professor Lawrence Drizal is our leader here at MSU on this project. He's working very closely with another member of our team, Dr. Ray Bowman, who's the person who's going to lead the Corktown portion of the effort. This IACME project in Michigan has two focal points, one here in East Lansing and one in the Corktown region of Detroit. It's co-located with another of these manufacturing institutes, LIFT. The institute stood up by our friends at the University of Michigan in lightweight metals. So here we have a facility in Detroit. Talk about the image of resurgence in Detroit. Two advanced research facilities right there in Corktown, side by side, working together, both of them working on the challenge of how to reduce mass. We're very happy to be partnered with a number of great institutions. We're part of LIFT as well. Our colleagues at Michigan also have activities in IACME. So this is a great example of where, although we may battle on the football field, we come together to solve the most challenging problems around the world.
The bottom line, says Dean Kempel, is the MSU College of Engineering is on the move.
Our goal, quite frankly, is to be seen as the fastest rising college of engineering in the nation. We're making great progress on that. We have over 6,400 students in the college right now. To give you a benchmark, that's roughly twice of where we were 8 years ago. This year we hired 23 faculty members to join the college. We're doing searches right now for another 17 faculty members. It's going to continue. Our goal is to have a net 60 new faculty members in our college by the time that we're done with this activity. And those hires are going to be in areas that really matter, right? We're not hiring because, well, we somebody in this area retired, let's fill it. We're looking at what the most challenging areas are in terms of research needs and teaching needs for the next 30 years. We're hiring the best and brightest in those areas. We're giving them the tools they need to succeed. For example, the new bio and engineering research facility. And then, quite frankly, management is getting out of the way and letting them do what they do, which is teach, do research, create, innovate, transfer knowledge upon, not just to our students, but the community around us. We're also very engaged in economic development. We spend a tremendous amount of time working with partners on campus, partners off campus, the central administration to attract really the high-end businesses and startups that are going to help transform the economy of mid-Michigan and with it helping the transformation of the economy for the great state of Michigan.
That's the dean of Michigan State University's College of Engineering, Leo Kemple. There's more at egr.msu.edu. And I'm Russ White for MSU Today. You're tuned to Greening of the Great Lakes inside MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Here's Kirk Heinze.
Our next guest is exceedingly well-versed with respect to Michigan's energy, past, present, and as we look to a more sustainable energy future. Liesl Clark has a plethora of responsibilities, the first of which is principal and co-founder of Five Lakes Energy, which is a policy consulting firm offering services in clean energy and the environment. But she also serves as president of the Michigan Energy Innovation Business Council, EIBC, and she is with us today to talk about an upcoming Energy Innovators Gala, November 10th, at the Kellogg Center, but also about a very important new initiative related to careers for women in the energy sector. Liesl, welcome to the program.
Great. Thanks for having me. I'm happy to be here.
First, a little bit about Five Lakes Energy. We've had you folks on before, but remind our listeners what you do.
Thanks. So Five Lakes Energy is a public policy consulting firm that focuses on clean energy and sustainability efforts. We all reside in Michigan, and most of our work is in Michigan, but we also do work in the Midwest region as well as nationally. We've built a model on the Clean Power Plan that's actually been deployed in 11 states now. So we're happy to be increasing that footprint.
And how long have you been around?
So Five Lakes Energy was created 6 years ago by Skip Press and myself, and now we've grown to where we are four principals, including Douglas Jester, an East Lansing native, actually a New Mexican native, but been in East Lansing for a long time, and Jamie Scripps, who's from Northport, Michigan. So we're thrilled to have four principals and a few consultants working with us as well.
Well, that's great. We've had Skip on the program before, and now it's a pleasure to have you on the program
great,
as well.
Great, thank you.
A very important initiative, it segues or it dovetails very nicely with STEM, I think. It's about advancing women in energy. Tell us about it, AWE.
Well, we're really excited about AWE and had a fantastic inaugural event just about a week ago. The focus of the organization is to work to create opportunities for women in energy. We know that there are a lot of women already active in this industry, but our thought was to create opportunities for mentorship, for networking, and also for professional development. One of the early focuses has been on how do we help women who are interested in being on boards either get board ready or find the right boards to be in good positions. There's a lot going on in this country, and the more that we have different voices, a diversity of voices, the more that we get better outcomes. And so that's really the focus of the organization.
And what better way to do the launch than have Patty Poppe, the first CEO at Consumers Energy, first female CEO in the history of the company?
Well, we really have just a wonderful wealth of women leaders here in Michigan in the energy space. And Patty is certainly, you know, one of the shining gems. We were also really lucky to have Valerie Brader in attendance. attendance, Chairman Sally Talberg, who's been certainly a supporter, as well as Tanya Pozlowski, who's the president of the organization. She's the president of the organization of MISO States, mm-hmm. which is a very important group in the energy industry. And then Commissioner Rachel Eubanks joined us as well. So, you know, it was about 120 strong women in the room. And Patty Poppe was just a fantastic presenter to talk about how she sees leadership, where she saw her mentors come from, and how she thinks about issues of diversity, because it is a challenge, you know, even in this day and age, to make sure that we're lifting all boats.
Well, if parents are listening to this program, or young women who are thinking about careers, going off to college or in college, what are some of the opportunities for women in the energy sector?
Well, see, this is one of the things that got me interested, because I think that our energy sector can sometimes look a little stale. And I really wanted to figure out a way to communicate with younger women the exciting and innovative parts of the energy industry. And, you know, Patty does put it into important perspective. So she talks about an example of when you think about our national grid, which is voted by engineers as the engineering marvel of the last century. So this is nothing to be trifled with. It's very, our grid is critical and it's very important. But when you think about our current energy grid, it looks kind of like I-75 going up the middle of Michigan. It goes one way. The grid of the future is going to look more like downtown Detroit, where you've got on-ramps and off-ramps, and there's a lot more going on. As we start to talk about issues like demand response, smart grid, distributed generation, et cetera. So I want to help those interesting things that I'm very passionate about reach younger women and reach women who also think in different ways, right? To help us solve some of those challenges. So we've been reaching out to women in college groups, both in public policy as well as in engineering and STEM related areas, because all these different types of minds are necessary to solve the problems that we're going to face.
We're talking about AWE, about advancing women in energy, a new group that's been established to promote careers, encourage women to pursue careers in the energy sector. My guest is Liesl Clark. She is a co-founder and principal of Five Lakes Energy. Liesl, your background, you did James Madison at Michigan State University, and then you have a master's in public policy. So you come at a career in energy through a policy background, a political science background, whereas someone like Patty Poppe more through an engineering background. So there is really a wide range of disciplines represented in the energy sector.
Yeah, there really is. And there's a lot of different perspectives that are necessary in order to deal with the puzzles of the future. So a lot of the folks that are at the Public Service Commission may have engineering backgrounds, but also have economics backgrounds. Economics plays an important role here. So I come at it from an interdisciplinary approach. I'm somebody that's always had a passion and an interest for science. And occasionally I even think maybe I need to go back and get, you know, a little bit more in that area to help beef it up. I just do a lot of reading on the side. But all of this is important. The interdisciplinary approach, I think, is one of the things that's going to be critical in the future. But Patty, yeah, absolutely. She's got, you know, the mechanical engineering degree, I believe. And then she's also got a master's. So she's very well educated as well. But a variety of the women that are involved in this, you know, have different backgrounds. And so I think it's important to attract all those different perspectives and to think about mentoring.
Well, you've had the launch. Now, what are the immediate next steps?
So we were sort of thinking about one big event a year, and that one was a big event, which we were thrilled and very thrilled by the reception and by the interest. So we're working on some smaller networking opportunities that will happen scattered throughout the state over the course of the year. And then we're also working on some webinars so that people aren't always traveling, but we're able to bring people together and talk about sort of professional development. One of the first initiatives is this concept of how do we help women get on more boards? So how do we help women get board ready?
Let's switch over to the Michigan Energy Innovation Business Council and the gala coming up. First, a little bit about the council and then the gala, which Russ and I are going to have the pleasure of attending.
Great. So the council is about 100 advanced energy companies that are interested in promoting advanced energy in Michigan. So they come from all ranges of the advanced energy spectrum, from some more traditional players like ITC in the transmission space to others like you wouldn't expect necessarily like a Grainger. Our board is made up of large to small. We have Veolia, which is a district utility actually in the Grand Rapids area, down to small solar installers and organizations like that. We also cover the gamut when it comes to services. So we have some manufacturers who are building and deploying products and want to build and deploy more of those in Michigan. And what you'll hear from a lot of them is they do more of it out of state. We also have many in the service industry who are providing services to these organizations. So this group's been around for about 4 years now and growing strongly year to year. So we're really excited for another good year this year.
And coming up on November 10th, tell us a little bit about the gala.
So the gala is, again, a fourth annual event for us. It's our big fundraiser. We're thrilled to have had a series of fantastic keynotes, starting with Jigar Shah from Generate Capital 4 years ago, Chris Brown, who's the CEO of Vestas and has an important Michigan roots. We had a speaker, Jim Chen, from Tesla last year. And this year, we are so fortunate to have John Vieira, who's the director of sustainability from Ford. So John will be addressing the group and talking about the interaction between the advanced transportation space and the electricity space, because that gray area is
mobility,
getting smaller
and
smaller and smaller. There's so much that overlaps there. So we're really looking forward to that conversation. Mm-hmm. And then we also will give out our annual awards.
Well, we're looking forward to talking to some of your award winners, and our listeners can expect to hear from those on a future program. Liesl, in terms of the gala on November the 10th, it's at the Kellogg Center, and like you say, it's your fourth annual?
That's correct.
And again, we'll be talking to you there, looking forward to that, and to some of your award winners.
Yeah, and I should also say that if people are interested in attending, okay, you can go to our website, mieibc.org, and we do sell out early, but you can check in and see if tickets are still available.
See if tickets are still available. Well, I've been talking with Liesl Clark. She is the co-founder and principal of Five Lakes Energy. She also serves as president of the Michigan Energy Innovation Business Council. They'll celebrate their gala November the 10th at the Kellogg Center. Check on their website, EIBC, to see if there are any tickets available. Liesl, a pleasure having you on the program.
Great. Thanks for having me, Kirk.
That was Dr. Kirk Heinze with a sustainability-focused Greening of the Great Lakes segment inside MSU Today here on AM 870 WKAR. To read Kirk's blog and hear more Greening of the Great Lakes content, visit mlive.com/environment. WKAR.
I'm Scott Westerman. It's easy to peer into the unknown and worry, to look in the rearview mirror and regret. We can become paralyzed if we imagine some inevitable future pain we must endure, fearing that traumatic scars, real or imagined, will damage us beyond recognition. We sometimes choose to give up on a dream rather than risk the heartbreak inherent in the inevitable failures that show us the way to making them come true. How can people find seemingly unending reserves of energy and courage to try again and again, even as an objective mind tries to convince a subjective heart to give up? The Swiss psychiatrist Carl Jung challenges us to remember, I am not what has happened to me. I am what I choose to become. Those choices can make all the difference. Choose to believe that the scars are nothing more than tattoos with better stories. We are all warriors, and every warrior has them. Choose not to be a victim of your pain and struggle. Choose instead to go into battle to become someone else's hero. To paraphrase Emery Austin, some days there won't be a song in your heart. Choose to sing anyway. Choose to concentrate only on the one time and place over which you have total control. Choose how you react to the here and now. A very small percentage of people in this world will actually experience and live today, writes Steve Maraboli in his book Unapologetically You, Reflections on Life and Human Experience. So many people, he says, will be stuck on another day, another time that traumatized them and caused them to spiritually stutter, so they miss out on this day. As for future fears, Bishop Bielby Porteous gave us the wisdom in the 1700s. He said, he who foresees calamities suffers them twice over. And oh, how we love to live anywhere but the present. We'll hear a song that reminds us of how we mishandled a relationship and we relive it like it was yesterday. We'll see something that brings back a painful memory and replay the tape inside our heads at full volume. If at first we don't succeed, we may try again. But most things worth achieving require lots of trying. Fear of failure raises its ugly head and does its best to frighten us into losing focus, shutting down, avoiding necessity, giving up. So what do you fear? What triggers past regrets? When you step outside of your conscious mind and look at your fears from the point of view of a witness instead of a participant, how are they different? It's actually essential to allow yourself to fully feel the fear, to examine the root causes of your sorrow and regret. But do so with the wisdom of the now. The gift of experience is context. With time and reflection, we can forgive others and ourselves for past mistakes. We can feed the energy of faith that manifests the courage to do what needs to be done. Everything we experience can help us more clearly understand the suffering of others and develop a deeper appreciation of what we were put on this earth to do. It's easy to picture courage as a powerful echo across the canyons of doubt and distress. This isn't necessarily so. Author Marianne Rademacher tells us that courage does not always roar. Sometimes courage is the quiet voice at the end of the day singing, "I will try again tomorrow." So whatever your current situation, your task is to make your life a work of art that will be admired and inspire others. It will be hard work, but anything exceptional requires exceptional effort. Some long-forgotten sage threw down this gauntlet. At any given moment, you have the power to say this is not how the story is going to end. And there is only one moment in which you can write the next chapter. The now. I'm Scott Westerman at ScottWesterman.com. Now you've heard it. Go out and do it.
WKAR.
This is Jim Byram, president of the Michigan Agribusiness Association. It's especially troubling to agriculture these days during this election season to hear everyone bashing trade, from both presidential candidates to many congressional candidates. Across the board, trade all of a sudden has become a negative. But for agriculture, without trade, we don't have any place to sell what we produce. There's those that believe that we ought to consume what we grow here. Well, that's true. However, we grow a whole lot more here and produce a whole lot more here than we can ever consume. Without trade, agriculture suffers. In fact, without trade, our competitors are going to be eating our lunch literally around the world. All you have to do is look 90 miles off the southern coast of the United States in Cuba. Just this past week, the Chinese government signed 33 commercial agreements with the Cubans. They're 90 miles away. It's a classic example why we have to have trade agreements. NAFTA, been a sterling and remarkable success as we look at what we've been able to export to Canada, export to Mexico, such things as black beans, fruit crops to Canada, all across the board. Without trade, we suffer. And if we don't embrace trade agreements, if we don't look at the TPP, the harm that's being caused with our relationships just because of the negative rhetoric with NAFTA is actually unconscionable. We have great trading partners. If we don't have trade, others will fill the void. We've seen it happen around the world time and again, and this rhetoric is already hurting our standing around the world when we deal with trade and our existing trading partners. We have to change the rhetoric. We have to change the tone. And for agriculture especially, we have to trade.
This is MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR.
Thank you for listening to MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. To hear this show again, click on the radio tab at WKAR.org and scroll to MSU Today every Sunday afternoon at 4 o'clock on AM 870 WKAR.